Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, edition 37. I'm Tyler Brulé. It's Sunday, November 8th, 2009. And today I'm in London with our editor, Andrew Tuck, and our culture editor, Robert Bound, where we seem to have a bit of an Asian theme. Ahead on the programme, we'll be catching up with one of our correspondents who's just arrived back from a tour of China.
Talking to friends of mine who've lived in China for years, the job opportunities are fantastic, but they're really worried about the long-term damage to their health. If China's going to go green, it has to be about making money, about being able to do business. It's not going to do it out of altruism. It's going to do it because it makes business sense.
That was our contributing editor, Rachel Morarji. And we'll also be getting an update on Tokyo Design Week when we check in with our design editor.
It's actually one of the most different and surprising fairs that I've been to. You know, it completely stands out from the crowd in terms of quality. They don't push for quantity. Every single person I spoke with, I sort of found myself stopping and genuinely having a discussion.
That was Sarah Balmont, Monocle's design editor. And in our culture section, we'll be getting down and Nordic with this. I like you, but I don't like you back. That was I Don't Like Your Band by Annie. In a few moments, we'll be talking to Richard Lloyd Perry, Asia editor of the Times of London, about Obama's trip to Japan in the coming days. But first, let's catch up with Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Morning.
Look at Andrew.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Had a haircut.
You have new hair.
Well, not new hair. I have not had a transplant. I had a haircut. It's been the kind of recovery week. I've been kind of sprucing myself up a bit after
having a wash.
Having a wash.
Rob said there was a rumor in the office that you were going to get dreadlocks. You're going to get a weave for an upcoming trip to New York.
Yeah. It does all go a bit to pot that kind of last week of sending the issue. So I was a bit scruffy by the end of it.
There's a lot of talk of cornrows, isn't there? Yes. A lot of talk of cornrows. That's what we wanted.
Well, you're looking great this morning. You made a huge effort.
Yeah, I kind of I put a jumper on.
As opposed to the tank top you normally have around the office.
And you're looking good as well, Rob.
Let's not pretend.
Let's move this on from me to you.
Yeah, exactly. Fresh out the dressing gown, Andrew. That's all I can say.
Okay.
Don't put the spotlight on me.
But you always look groomed.
Oh, thank you, Andrew.
It's because you have your hairdresser come in to see you. No, you don't. No,
that's true. You know what happened to my poor hairdresser for our listeners? Shunji, who I've written about a couple of times in the Financial Times, and also I think we've mentioned them in this magazine. He's always a fixture at our parties. I had these panicked emails from readers last week who said, I went around to M Salon, and there's a branch of M Salon in Mayfair, or there's a branch of M Salon in Aoyama, and people said that the locks had been changed and there was a sign saying that the space had been repossessed. So last weekend, after we did the program, I set up a refugee center for people who needed new hair.
new hair again.
And there was cooking of food, and we were trying to structure a whole new business plan because the owners of M Salon fell out with the chaps in London, and now Shunji's going from hotel room to just cutting people's hair.
Homeless Shunji, that's not
my
good.
My God, he's a walk-in soup kitchen.
So anyway, we're thinking about maybe there might be M Salon will move to Monocle Salon, I thought.
Yeah, maybe when people are out on kind of missions in the office, one of those seats could be turned into a kind of a hairdressing seat, and we could do some...
That'd be ideal.
I think our finance...
A magazine and a trim in one.
Our finance director would love that idea. On Thursday, it will be wheels and flaps down for Air Force One as it makes its approach into Tokyo for President Barack Obama's two-day visit to Japan to meet with new Prime Minister Yukio Hatoyama. With the future of the U.S.-Japan alliance likely to be at the center of the discussion, along with more urgent security issues, we wanted to get a view on how this visit might unfold. Well, for a ringside perspective, we're joined by Richard Lloyd Perry, Asia editor of the Times of London and occasional Monocle contributor. He's on the line from Tokyo. Hello, Richard.
Hello there, Tyler.
Are they rolling the bunting out and the bands are, of course, polishing up for the arrival?
Well, I don't think it's going to be that kind of visit. It's going to be a much more sort of serious working visit than a big ceremonial occasion. I mean, they always arrange some kind of gimmicks. I mean, there'll no doubt be a rather cheesy exchange of gifts between Mr. Hatoyama and Obama as they emphasize what good chums they are. They've also got quite serious things to talk about. I mean, meetings between US presidents and Japanese prime ministers, in recent years have never really been that interesting because they don't really have any bilateral problems. Things just tick along, really, and they accommodate one another pretty easily. But Hatoyama is very different from people that previous American administrations have had to deal with. And he has you know, thrown a bit of a spanner in the works by talking about the US-Japan alliance and ways in which he wants to alter the tone of that, if not the substance.
And does that mean that a lot of the discussion is going to center around where they're going to redeploy or reallocate US troops to, and are they shoving them all to Okinawa? Is that going to be the center of the discussion, or is it also as much focused on North Korea and other local security issues?
Yeah, I mean, on North Korea and regional security issues, they pretty much agree, I think. I mean, it may be that Obama is looking to engage with North Korea a bit faster than the Japanese would feel comfortable with. But I think they accept that that's going to happen and isn't really in their control. But, yeah, it's on the question of these troops. I mean, the U.S., since the war, has had tens of thousands of troops in Japan, and they fulfill a very important strategic role. I mean, there are Marines in the southern island of Okinawa who would be the ones to fight any future war over Taiwan, for example, or North Korea. But the problem is that they're nearly all of them concentrated in this really relatively small island, Okinawa, and there are just far too many of them for the size of the place, and there are always problems, you know, accidents involving helicopters, noise of aircraft taking off, and occasionally nasty criminal incidents, you know, when U.S. servicemen have raped or assaulted local women. And it's created a lot of bad feeling. And Hatoyama, during his very successful election campaign, made a rather vague promise to do something about this and to improve things for Okinawans. But now he's in power and is prime minister, I think he's discovering that, you know, what you can actually do is really very limited, because however much the Okinawans dislike having all these American soldiers in their backyard, no one else in Japan wants them either.
Richard, from your perspective, it's, I guess we're almost 2 months or 2 months into Hatoyama being PM. What do you make of the man? And I would be very keen to hear from the perspective of you being a foreign correspondent, but also what does the local media, what does the Japanese media make of him as well?
Well, I think he really is something different. I mean, you know, I've been covering Japanese politics for getting on for 15 years, and honestly, at times it's a struggle to really make it very interesting for foreign readers. But Hatoyama and his cabinet really are something new. I mean, the Liberal Democratic Party, you know, which they defeated spectacularly, was a very conservative, very predictable institution. Suddenly you've got these people in power who really are centre-left liberals. Some of them are former socialists, and they have a completely different mindset and set of values. It's much more unpredictable, and they sincerely, I think, want to bring about change. I mean, the problem, obviously, is that they don't really have the experience, and that's shown in some ways. The sort of coordination between different members of the cabinet hasn't been that good. Hatoyama has not always seemed consistent in his public utterances, including on this question of the American bases. But it is really very interesting. As for what the local media make of them, I think in some ways they're rather nonplussed. I mean, over the years, the LDP, you know, was the government. The Liberal Democratic Party was Japan. And so big newspapers and TV companies really didn't need to take the opposition very seriously because they were just the opposition. But now the opposition is the government. And these powerful media organizations, which were used to knowing exactly who to go to and who to call to find out what was going on, are having to start from scratch, really, with the new government. So it's very interesting.
Will it be a comfortable Thursday evening dinner when all of them sit down, including Mrs. Hatoyama, who seems like a bit of a colorful character?
To call Mrs. Hatoyama colorful is really a gross understatement. She is verging on being a fruitcake, to be honest. She's very interesting indeed. She describes herself as, what is it, something like a lifestyle coordinator. And she's given over the years a series of interviews where she's revealed extraordinary things about herself, including the fact that in the 1970s, I believe, she actually flew to Venus on a UFO, which will no doubt do
so that's
her husband's foreign policy if he ever makes it to outer space.
So Japan's first astronaut, not just female.
Well, a first kind of interstellar traveller across the dimensions, yeah, to make it into the Prime Minister's office, yeah.
But does this not cause huge embarrassment? I mean, I guess going back to local media, do they just indulge this or ignore it?
Now, that's the really interesting thing. In common with other foreign correspondents, I wrote a story about Mrs. Hatoyama and her wackiness. And these were picked up by the local media, because I was discussing this with Japanese journalists, and I was telling them that if a British prime minister, for example, had a wife who was this wacky, his political opponents would definitely use it to kind of embarrass him and, you know, put him in an uncomfortable position. But here that really hasn't happened. People don't seem to mind that she says these rather strange, although harmless things. I mean, I think the truth is that she falls into that category in Japan of the talento or talent, which are kind of professional celebrities, really. And they appear on TV a lot, and they are expected to say unusual and outrageous and entertaining things, and nobody really takes it all that seriously. So, no, Mr. Hatoyama doesn't seem at all embarrassed by his wife, Miyuki. In fact, no, they seem rather touchingly close and fond of one another.
Well, Andrew's quite excited about it because he noticed that she's a big advocate of breathing in sunshine, and Andrew likes to breathe in sunshine from time to time.
I think she does more than breathe it in. She eats the sun. That was what she said, that, she every morning she reaches up and picks off a piece of the sun and eats it. Which does wonders for the digestion.
Richard, I just wanted to ask, sorry to bring it back down level or two, but I just wanted to ask one little question, because we've been keeping an eye, obviously, here at on the run-up to Copenhagen and the COP15 conference, and obviously Japan held the Kyoto conference and has been a key mover in what's happened with climate change and the environment. Do you have any sense that they're kind of bargaining between America and Japan doing pre-deals before Copenhagen? Is the debate about what's going to come after Kyoto and climate big in Japan?
Yes, it is quite important here. I mean, as you say, the Kyoto conference was held here, and so the Japanese feel that they have a kind of, you know, there's a certain amount of kind of prestige at stake in making sure that it all works out. Now, they weren't very good at keeping their Kyoto promises. They were quite bad, in fact. But the new government, Mr. Hatoyama, has set an ambitious goal. I think it's a 25% cut in greenhouse gas emissions based on 1990 levels, which sounds pretty impressive. The problem he has is persuading, you know, Japanese industry to take on that burden, because what they always say, and there's some truth in it, is that Japanese industry is actually, you know, pretty efficient already. I mean, after the oil shocks in the early 1970s, they had rather a scare, and they became a lot more fuel efficient just from reasons of strategic necessity. So it's harder for them to improve on that than it might be with, you know, say the US or certainly, you know, places like India or China. He's having a crack at setting an ambitious target, and I think he's getting credit and praise for that here.
And Richard, I presume you'd have to cut down on the flights to Venus if you wanted to diminish your carbon footprint.
Well, I can't remember, but my guess is that Mrs. Hatoyama didn't fly on a kind of fossil fuel aircraft.
Oh, right.
It was some kind of astral travel, I would guess.
It wasn't an ANA flight.
Richard, I'm astro traveling over your way. Hopefully I'll see you later in the week.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tyler.
Thanks.
Bye.
Richard Lloyd Perry in Tokyo, thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly from London. We're back after this, after having some bites of sunshine.
Absolutely.
You're back with the Monocle Weekly. In our December-January issue that hits shops on Wednesday, our contributing editor, Rachel Moragi, traveled to China to look at the greening of the nation and profile the players and brands who are hoping to take their products global. Rachel's just back from Dalian. She joins in studio. Welcome back.
Hi there.
So impressions. I mean, first, set up the story that you wrote for us, but then also just to the personal side of Rachel Moragi traveling back to China.
I lived in China for about 7 years, so this is my first trip back. It's been a 5-year gap. And the green story was a really good way of getting a sense of how China's changing generally. A lot of these companies, big sort of companies that started out as battery manufacturers or doing kind of little rinky-dink manufacturing, have really expanded and are really poised to become global players. Well, at least they have the potential to get that way if they can get their head around the branding side of it, if they can learn to be a little bit more open to the press, if they can learn to sort of market themselves and polish themselves a little bit more. They've got a way to go there, I think.
Is there a bit of a PR backstory there, just in terms of the reception that you received and just, yeah, how they deal with a journalist coming from the UK?
There's one of the companies which features quite largely in our story, Build Your Dreams. And this is the one that started out as a battery manufacturer in Shenzhen, and they're now making electric cars and solar panels, and they've got big plans to roll out an electric car before the end of the year. Remains to be seen whether they actually do that, but that's certainly what they're hoping to do. You know, I applied for an interview with them about 6 weeks before I went, and there were endless phone calls with young Chinese women. What was the email? When did you send it? Who are you? And I'd have these conversations in Mandarin every few mornings. Finally, I got hold of a PR in Hong Kong, and they tried for me, and I thought I wasn't going to get in to see them. And it was, you know, the usual China way. I met somebody in a bar the night before I was supposed to leave Shenzhen. I thought the whole trip was going to be fruitless, and the guy in the bar said, oh, I know somebody at BYD. I can make a couple of calls for you. I'll get you in. And so that's how I got in to do my interview. And 2 days later, I got a very nice email from the PR saying, I'm terribly sorry, no one can see you.
Brilliant. Your impression, are these companies really going to make a go of it, and whether they bring in outside talent to help them with their logos and their branding? But when you actually were out on the factory floor, when you were talking to the various players, did you get a sense that if they get, you know, a couple of things lined up, they really have a shot at it?
Yeah, I mean, there were two things that really came across with going around China and looking at some of these companies. One was scale. BYD is like a small town. I mean, I think it's half the size of Cork in Ireland, I mean, in terms of population. I think Broad, Monocle have written a little bit about this Chinese air conditioning company. They have a place in central China, Changsha, called Broad City. It's so big, it's like a small town. I mean, the scale that they can throw at manufacturing, at product, often it's product engineering. So they're looking at how to build a product faster and more efficiently using human labor rather than perhaps doing it through high-tech innovations at this stage. That was one thing. And the second thing was just the way that talent is coming back. 5 years ago, when I left China, or 10 years ago when I was sort of still working there, people who were really bright were desperate to get out, and they wanted to move overseas, and they, you know, they wanted to study overseas. And I met so many people who spoke 3 or 4 languages, who'd worked in the West as scientists or, you know, computer engineers or really wide variety of different things, who had come back to China, who said that they were going to get better quality of life in China, that they were going to have more opportunities there. And I think they wanted to be part of something exciting and something that was changing. And these are people who are really bright, who 5 years ago would have been working in the States or working in Europe. And I think there's a kind of reversal of the brain drain that you're seeing in China now. And I think that's going to be really important, because it's going to mean that at the top of companies and also in government, some of these people were members of the Communist Party, you're going to have people who have a much greater understanding of the West.
So on one side, you look at these factories or these brands that have a shot of being real positive players on the energy stage. But then if you look at the streets of China, if you look at urban China, what was your view 5 years later?
Well, start with a positive note. All of the bins in most of the cities have a little recycling and non-recyclable side. And not that that is really necessary, because there's lots of poor people living on rubbish dumps who can recycle your stuff for you. But the air is toxic. I mean, you know, like a brown sludge some days. I'm still coughing and wheezing. I mean, maybe that I'm not used to it, but I think it's also got considerably worse. And the second thing was just, I mean, the scale of development, I just didn't recognize. I mean, I was expecting not to recognize Beijing after the Olympics and all the building that went on there. But Shanghai, there's a 2010 Expo, and they're just knocking down the city. And Shanghai had really unusual architecture. It had all these lane houses that were built. You don't see them anywhere else in the world. And they were like little communities, absolutely being flattened. The house that I used to live in, beautiful Art Deco place, flattened. I mean, just acres of rubble. And where it wasn't rubble and it's been rebuilt, it's just formless skyscrapers. Shanghai looks like every other Chinese city, which is pretty charmless.
And were there any bright spots when you traveled around? And I mean, because, you know, we hear about, there are plans, and certainly we've talked from time to time in the magazine about the greening of some cities, and certainly some positive urban initiatives going on. But are they quite few and far between?
I think there's bits and pieces in the major cities. There were a lot of organic shops. There was a carbon neutral hotel in Shanghai. There's certainly a sense among kind of certain young hip people that being green is trendy, which I think is a positive thing. There's outreach stuff to primary schools. But one of the most interesting things was Dalian, which is a city in northeastern China. And they've got very low air pollution, fantastic wooded hillsides, which have all pretty big, recently newly planted. And there's a real sense there that being, not just being green, but making the city pleasant, making it a nice environment, having green space is going to attract top talent. So if China's going to go green, it has to be about making money, about being able to do business. It's not going to do it out of altruism. It's going to do it because it makes business sense.
Do you sense, Rachel, that there's any kind of message that's unified from the top? Because what's funny when you describe it and when other people have talked about it, you know, on one hand you're seeing environmentalists, you know, prosecuted and kind of run out of town for kind of their activities. And on the other hand, you have these kind of entrepreneurs saying, yeah, China can be a green oasis. But is there any kind of joined up central government ambition about what China should do about its environment?
I think on the central government side, there's a real waking up that they've got to clean up. I think about a third of the river water in northern China is so polluted it can't be used for anything, not industrial use, not agricultural use, and it can't be cleaned up. So the top leaders have a really clear sense that they've got a big problem on their hands that they have to tackle. But it applies to the environment and pretty much anything else that China does. They actually have a saying that the government has a policy and the regions have another policy that cancels it out. And so the government's power just isn't absolute. They can't push things down all over the country in a way that they'd want to. You've got local fiefdoms who basically want to make money and are looking out for number one. And if that doesn't add up to being green, then, you know, and if environmentalists are standing in the way of profits for them, then they might get run out of town.
And just a follow-on, so if you want to be an international city in China, you know, even looking at somewhere like Shanghai, is there a risk that they just have lost the game, in a sense? If they've destroyed all this architecture, the air is polluted. If you were a banker or, you know, you're looking for someone to make a headquarters, do you think that now Shanghai would not be seen as an option because people would think, actually, I just can't face sending our kind of team there from Paris or from New York or from London?
It depends on how it evolves. I mean, I think in China at the moment, 18 million people a year move to the cities. The scale of urbanisation is not like anything you've ever seen or anything that's ever happened before. So Shanghai is not a static thing. I mean, and so there is still some charming architecture in the centre. The question is whether they preserve what they've got still standing. Or, you know, there was a beautiful guest house in the centre of town called the Raging Guest House, which had all these manicured gardens. They're building a car park and a skyscraper. And the French concession was supposed to be a no development zone. So I don't think the game's lost yet, but if it carries on the way it's going now, I think it's going to be a real issue. Talking to friends of mine who've lived in China for years, the job opportunities are fantastic, but they're really worried about the long-term damage to their health.
Great, Rachel Marge. We look forward to hearing more about Dalian in our February issue, not to foreshadow too much. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly from London. We're back with Culture in a moment. You're back with The Monocle Weekly, where it's time for a bit of culture. Rob, you're going to take us north, because we've been a bit east-focused so far this morning.
Yes, we have. Yeah, we're going to go north, just a little bit north. We're going to Norway. We often go to Norway. Do you mind?
I don't know. I
well,
love Norway.
All right. This is Annie, who we haven't heard from for far too long.
Ages.
What happened to her?
I don't know.
Hiatus is what happened to her. So she's been borrowed away, coming up with the follow-up to Animal, which seems like, I don't know.
Which
like
we loved.
5 years ago.
Five years ago, yeah.
This is basically this is the most amazing pop record, the new album. It's called Don't Stop, and this is a track from it called I Don't Like Your Band. It's pop as it was meant to be.
That was Annie with I Don't Like Your Band. Well, I don't mind if she's been around for a while, because that's fantastic.
Yeah, it was worth the wait, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, it has many shades of what we've heard before, but that's absolutely fine.
She's one of those people also that kind of, you know, 5 years ago was doing all the things that you know, the sort of current crop of female sort of electro pop stars are doing. You know, there's LaRue in there, there's also Daft Punk in there. But all the up and coming over the last couple of years have sort of been taking big, big cues, I think, from her earlier work. Yeah.
Andrew, are you tapping your little feet under the desk?
Yeah, I was slightly thrown. I thought it was going to be the sequel to Annie the Musical, so I was a bit disappointed at first, but then I got into it. I loved it.
You got your gun.
But we're still a little bit fixated on Scandinavian lasses on this program. I don't know why.
I don't know why. Don't ask me.
There's not too many. There aren't too many complaints, but we've had some angry letters lately from Australia.
Yeah, I think a few people think we're looking a bit too far north and not far enough south.
I've got a good one for next week, actually.
From where?
From Australia.
Oh, right, it's from Finland. Just to wind them up.
Yeah, from just a bit further north in Norway. Just the next town up, Bergen.
Well, we're actually not going to be going south the next segment. We're actually going to be heading over to Tokyo to talk to Sarah Bellman. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. You're back with The Monocle Weekly, where it's time to head back to Tokyo to see and hear what was on show at Design Week over the past few days. Having raised its game over the last 3 to 4 years, Tokyo Design Week may not have the pulling power of Milan in terms of sheer numbers, but it does attract all the big names in international industrial design and architecture who like nothing more than touring Tokyo's endless array of bars and clubs. Our design editor, Sarah Bellman, is on the line, and she joins us from Tokyo. Sarah, of course, you didn't see any bars or clubs over the last few days, right?
Well, you know, I somehow managed to plan the trip around Tokyo Halloween, which was quite exciting. So I was actually at the Colette Halloween party. Sadly, didn't really have an outfit, but someone lent me a hat. But that was rather brilliant.
That's a poor showing.
You know, I had my moment with a giant dancing Hello Kitty, and my picture was taken. And I'd quite like that to go out with my next monocolumn. Andrew, what do you think?
I think you with a big Hello Kitty would be good.
Now, Sarah, It's important to point out the fact that you are, in fact, you were a Tokyo virgin anyway.
Mm, yes, that's right. Yeah, my first time.
In terms of impressions, and Tokyo Design Week compared to Cologne, ICFF in New York, and certainly Milan, how does it differ, in your opinion?
Gosh, you know, it's actually one of the most different and surprising fairs that I've been to. You know, it completely stands out from the crowd in terms of quality. They don't push for quantity. I mean, you've got the sort of the two main shows, which is 100% design and then Design Tide. Now, the more of creative of the two is Design Tide. And there's only about sort of 45 to 50 very small exhibitors. And it's very sort of up-and-coming designers, but they're genuinely showing prototypes or showing for the first time. And they don't show in a sort of standard hall where you just walk up and down corridors. They actually have a sort of a very unique environment. So this year they got the founder of Suppose Design Office to design this rather wonderful sort of cloud landscape. So it meant that you sort of wandered around and kind of found the product, so there was that sense of discovery. And it meant that it was a genuinely sort of exciting experience. I think that reflected as well, you know, 100% design is the more commercial, but again, they did have a lot of debuts and showcases for the first time. So overall, every single person I spoke with, I sort of found myself stopping and genuinely having a discussion and taking all the bumps and thinking, you know, I actually wasn't going to throw it away and, you know, bring it all the way back home with me to London. So, because, you know, you get so used to seeing the same things, and it was just a genuinely exciting experience for me.
One of the things I noticed, and certainly in the introduction, when you're there, there are so many other industrial designers. You see all of the big players, all of the owners from factories in Milan and France and Spain and elsewhere. So do you think, and you don't have to be diplomatic about this, but do you think a lot of people are also going to Japan, I mean, for true inspiration, in the sense that here are some ideas that they might be able to rip off in the months to come?
Well, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't find it all that unsurprising, really, if that was the case. I mean, certainly it's an inspiring city, and against that backdrop, you know, you have got inspiring designs coming out. The pieces that I saw were so wonderfully sort of put together and so simple, but, you know, they were the ones kind of drawing the crowds. And again, that was something that was being put forward by the younger designers as well as the sort of the older manufacturers.
And Sarah, it's Andrew here. I just wondered, when you're walking around the halls, are the majority of people who are turning up, are they Japanese? Is there a big European contingent of people there, or people from the US? And, you know, do you see people from other Asian countries, from China, etc., coming to look around the halls?
Bhutan?
Nepal?
Yeah, well I was actually talking to one of the designers, and he said he was surprised by the amount of sort of people coming over from kind of Southeast Asia and other countries within this region. I was also spotting the kind of the same old faces from the European press circuit as well. So it is kind of drawing an international crowd.
You're getting very wary of these people, Sarah. God, same old faces, the same old bump.
Yeah, no, dumping it in the bin.
No, but do you know what? But that's why I found this show so genuinely exciting. No, honestly, it was something sort of very unexpected, really. And the reception as well. People are very warm and they give you lots of time. You know, they really want to talk to you about their products. There was one designer in particular who I saw called Yota Kakuda. And he showed a beautiful table and sort of lacquerware collection of cups. And apparently, you know, Jasper Morrison visited the show and spent ages talking with him and, you know, sort of watched this space. I think, you know, a lot of the designers coming here, and in fact, when I was talking to them, they are looking for manufacturers. And I think the intention behind Design Tide and by keeping the collective very small is to create that platform from which to kind of generate the productivity. I met with Masaki Yokokawa-san, who is the CEO of Sabone, who also sits on the board. And he said that that was something, you know, that they're really trying to give to the younger designers, to give them experience of the business and to kind of give them that launching pad, because it just doesn't exist here. And he very much sees his role on the board of directors there as sort of enabling that to happen. And I think perhaps that's what other shows miss out on, because you pay money and they're sort of after that rather than perhaps fostering and generating that kind of interest and spirit locally.
All right, Sarah, on a serious note, I know you're not averse to a microphone and a backing track.
Oh!
Have you been rocking your Beyoncé out there? Have you made some fans?
I'm so sad I haven't had a chance to yet, and I'm desperate. I actually feel I'm like dragging people saying, come on, let's go to karaoke. But, you know, I've got a couple of days left, so it's definitely going to happen.
And have you had a retail moment or two?
Do you know what? When I arrived, it was very warm and sunny, and I checked the weather forecast before I came out, and it was warm and sunny. But the weather has turned, so I actually bought myself a coat from Muji, which is rather lovely and is keeping me nice and warm. But I should have probably bought a bobble hat and scarf as well, because it seems like it's getting colder. Beautiful blue skies, though, but yeah. Winter's coming, I think.
Great. Well, thank you for the weather update from Tokyo, Sarah.
Sorry, I slipped into weather girl mode. I don't know what's wrong with me.
have a great time out there. We'll see you back in London.
Thanks, Sarah.
Bye, Sarah.
Bye, guys.
Okay, bye. That was Sarah Bauman. We're back after this. Back with the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for, it says on the script here, it says time for outro chat.
Wow, what do you think that might be? What should we talk about?
Whatever you want, Rob Bound. Are you happy with today's show?
We can start
again if you want.
Well, that's all right. We've been here now. We're going to run out of time, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Andrew?
I really liked it today. It was really jolly.
It was quite jolly. It was east, but it didn't feel chilly.
not even the Nordic bit today either.
No, that was decidedly warm.
And it's very good having Sarah on the phone. It's funny because, you know, obviously working on Monocle, we get to go to Tokyo quite regularly. And just hearing someone, every time when someone goes there for the first time, it's really fascinating how it kind of slightly changes their perspective. Just the fact that Japan still looks slightly inward. So it has so many things that people haven't seen elsewhere in the world. So just that, hearing her excitement about that sense of discovery about being there was wonderful.
Well, I'm jumping on the plane to Tokyo right after this, and I'm hoping that maybe I will get an invite from our friends at the Foreign Ministry, and maybe I can go and sing a Venus duet with Mrs. Hatoyama. Maybe there's going to be some sort of after party.
The B-sides eat the sun.
Exactly. Well, that's all for this week's Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineers are Chris Sharp and Dom Boucher at the Sound Company here in London. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please send us an email to weekly@monocle.com. And don't forget to visit our Monocle column on our website, also at monocle.com. And if you're in London or Los Angeles, our bumper December January issue will be hitting shops on Wednesday. Next week, we'll be co-anchoring out of Tokyo and London, me at the studios of J-Wave and the boys here in London. But for now, from London, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Bound.
And here to play us out with a track from our forthcoming album, Monocle Live Volume 1, is Bird with Hakyu No Dance Hall. See you next week. Gami desu yo.
そこには青春の日々いろいろあるのだけどそれなりに楽しいのよ夢と不安が絡む多感な年頃なの書き綴ったダイアリー戸棚の隅に隠す今日は嬉しいことがあって心躍るのこんな小さな部屋も私だけのダンスホール
焼き付けて。